Hello, welcome to the Green Living Show. I'm your host, Alex Archer. Green Living is the show for Build a Better Planet, a nonprofit organization promoting sustainability. Join us as we look at the many ways we can live healthy and live green. Now, today we are not joined by Chef Yvette, unfortunately. She has taken this week off. But I do have an in-studio guest, Inez.
Welcome. Hi, how are you?
Hey, and we are in Brooklyn today.
Yes, we are. What a beautiful day.
We're by the beach, actually.
So. Yeah, it wasn't too good of a night of sleep, a lot of work, but I'm so excited to head up a bed and get some nice sleep that I much deserve right now.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And today we are doing, we're doing a variation on a recipe. The recipe we were doing originally, these are Southwestern egg rolls, and originally they called for black beans and spinach.
Ooh.
But, yeah, no, right?
Wow. I might skip the bed and go straight to breakfast.
Right. Making you hungry?
Yeah.
But we're going to do a little twist on this today, because instead of the spinach, we're going to use seaweed.
Ooh, getting closer.
Yeah. Now, our two main ingredients, black beans obviously are legumes, and so therefore they're a very good source of fiber. And yeah, you and I had a fiber discussion earlier. Fiber is very good for you. It keeps the system moving.
Yes.
Also, it is a good source of proteins, especially if you're a vegetarian or vegan. This is a good way to get your protein, eat your beans. And now seaweed. So we're using that as a substitute for spinach in this recipe. And seaweed is very good for people who might, it's a good source of iodine for people who might have thyroid problems. And also it's a good source of selenium, which again is also for people who might have thyroid problems. So very, very good for thyroid health, seaweed. So.
Yes.
Yeah. So, what we're going to use, we're going to do 2 tablespoons of cooking oil. And, of course, we like canola or olive oil because it's better for you.
Yes.
We're going to do 1 skinless, boneless chicken breast. But, you know, if you are a vegetarian or vegan, you don't need to add this. That's totally optional. 2 tablespoons of green onion, minced. 2 tablespoons of red bell pepper, also minced. 1/3 cup corn kernels, and make sure they're non-GMO. We don't like to eat genetically modified frankenfoods. 1/4 cup of black beans, obviously drained, rinsed and drained. And 2 tablespoons of our seaweed. And, yeah, you know, seaweed used to be kind of hard to find. You used to have to go to, like, ethnic markets or Chinatown, you know. Every city has a Chinatown now.
Of course, yeah.
Actually, I think New York we have a few. We have one in Brooklyn and Queens and Manhattan. But now it's gotten kind of trendy. So you can actually get, like, especially dried seaweed, you can get pretty much in a lot of stores now. So. And if you want to be brave, you can do 2 tablespoons of jalapeno peppers, half a tablespoon.
That'll light you up.
It'll also help with the fiber, by the way.
Yeah.
Half a tablespoon of fresh parsley, and 1/2 teaspoon of ground cumin. Some little extras, 1/2 teaspoon of chili powder, again, just like the jalapeno peppers, that's to your own taste. 1/3 teaspoon of salt. Again, that's also to taste. And if you're feeling really brave, you can add about a pinch of cayenne pepper. And 3/4 cup shredded Monterey Jack cheese. And 5 flour tortillas. And 1 quart of oil. And again, we're going to use canola oil for this because this is for frying. And you really don't want to do high temperatures with olive oil because that releases antioxidants. So instead, we're going to do the canola.
Interesting.
Yeah,
wow.
Right. Keep the free radicals at bay.
Yeah.
Keeps you younger looking.
Oh, yeah. I would definitely keep that in mind.
Definitely. And it also prevents cancer, so. All righty. So I think we're ready to get started. What we're going to do, we're going to take our olive oil and rub that over the chicken breast in a medium saucepan over medium heat. We're going to cook the chicken. Obviously, you want it to be well cooked. You want kind of semi-cooked chicken. That's not good. Should take about 5 minutes per side until the meat is obviously no longer pink and the juices run clear. Heat the remaining 1 tablespoon of oil in a medium saucepan over medium heat. Stir in our green onion and our red peppers. And cook and stir for about 5 minutes until tender. I like to let that sit in there. That kind of gives the flavor of the peppers and the onions. And then we're going to dice our chicken. I like chunks. I like things to be chunky. And mix into the pan with onion and red pepper. Mix in our corn, our black beans, our seaweed, our jalapeno, parsley, cumin, chili powder, salt, and cayenne pepper. And we're just going to cook and stir all of this for about 5 minutes. So it's really not that long. We're talking about a pretty quick recipe. And just, you know, keep cooking and stirring until it's well blended and tender. And remove from the heat and stir in our Monterey Jack cheese so that it melts. And I'll say, if you do happen to have somebody that you're cooking for who is lactose intolerant, and again, you can leave the cheese out. That's optional. Now, what we're going to do, we're going to wrap our tortillas in a clean, moist cloth. And the reason you want to keep it moist, and by the way, if you're doing traditional egg rolls with the egg roll wrapper, same thing, you want to keep them moist. Because when they dry out, they start to break on you, and they kind of fall apart.
Yeah.
And so with the tortillas, you're going to microwave on high for about a minute. And remember, you're keeping them in a moist cloth, so you want to keep them kind of damp. That's the idea. Until hot and pliable, so you want to be able to roll them like an egg roll wrapper. But we're going with the tortilla to kind of give it that Southwest kind of flavor. So what you're going to do, now that you have your tortillas warm, you're going to lay them out, and you could do this like on a cookie sheet or some wax paper, and you're going to spoon even amounts of the mixture onto each tortilla, so kind of like you're making a burrito, you know?
Okay.
And then you're going to fold the ends of the tortilla and roll, so you're kind of like tucking and rolling around the mixture, secure with toothpicks, and arrange in a medium dish, cover with plastic, and place in the freezer. And you can freeze for about 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So then, so this is something that it's good for a party. You can do this ahead of time, you know? Do all the prep work ahead of time.
And so you don't have to run around, you know, at the party and missing on the fun.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So then just before you're ready to eat them, what you're going to do is you're going to take your canola oil, because, again, you want to use a safe oil for frying, especially because this is high heat. We're going to do 375 degrees Fahrenheit. And we're going to take our deep-fry frozen stuffed tortillas.
Oh, God, that sounds so good right now.
Yeah. And you're going to do 10 minutes. You're going to fry them for 10 minutes each or until they're dark golden brown. And then you're going to drain on paper towels, obviously, to absorb the extra grease. And you know how I would serve these? I would serve these with, like, guacamole and sour cream.
Sounds good. I know, as much as my eyes are just closing right now, gosh, I want to taste that.
Isn't that awesome?
Gosh, that'd be great for like next barbecue or grilling, you know?
Cinco de Mayo.
Especially with this weather coming up. Gosh, about to do this later on today or, you know?
Yeah,
right?
Cinco de Mayo is coming up, so you can have that with some margaritas.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Please.
Awesome. So yes, it's a very good party recipe. I'm thinking like for a backyard barbecue, like you said, backyard barbecue party. Yeah. So there you have it. You have some seaweed and black bean egg rolls. Easy.
Oh, nice.
Set for your party, since it is getting to be outdoor party season. And Inez, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm going to go take a nap and then go make some tortillas.
Cool. Do you have a site, and you do some radio as well? And broadcast?
Yes. I actually just graduated from broadcasting school. You know, I wasn't using before. I'm a songwriter, singer.
Awesome.
But, you know, move into the entertainment industry. So I love people, love, you know, discussing ideas around every topic. Entertainment media is my number one topic to discuss that I cannot shut about. But I enjoy, like I said, discuss all around different ideas and meeting new people. So I'm looking forward where you know, my broadcasting degree will lead me to.
Cool. Well, where can they find you? Are you on Facebook or Twitter?
Yes. It's facebook.com/InezMusic. That's I-N-E-S-S music. Okay, and I hope to hear from you, and I'll talk to you soon.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And coming up next, we have a very special guest. Author Phil G. will be discussing his new book, Dirty Squatters. It's a look based on a true story at life in England during the Thatcher years. Coming up next. And we're back with Brandon Broderick. Welcome.
Hey, how are you?
All right. Now, Brandon, you've been on the show before with your band Cotton, but you've been doing some solo projects lately.
Yeah, I've been working on a lot of solo acoustic material. I'm going in more of a solo direction right now, writing more simple, like, concise songs.
Very cool. Is there something you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, it's something I'm working on at the moment and trying to build. It's something I've been doing for a while, kind of on the side, but now I'm kind of bringing it out more to the forefront.
Very cool. Do you have any plans for the summer coming up?
Yeah, I do plan on pretty much playing out wherever I can and getting my songs out there. So I have a lot of gigs lined up, solo acoustic gigs lined up, and I'm also planning on doing some recordings.
And I should point out, you're in New Jersey.
Yeah, Central Jersey.
Cool. If people would like to find out about you as a solo artist, where should they go?
Right now, my website is still under construction. But they can check out, if they go on Facebook and they just type in my name, Brandon Broderick, they can find my Facebook fan page on there. I'm kind of using that as my main website for now until I get my .com up and running.
Okay. Yeah, I love Facebook. It's awesome. You can post stuff, and it's so easy to use.
Definitely.
Cool. Was there anything you'd like to tell our listeners?
Yeah, I'm currently working on actual songs, and on my Facebook page, I'm planning on throwing up a song idea. I've been using just my iPhone 5 to kind of just record basic ideas. And I'm just recording, my songs on there, posting them up to get feedback, and I want feedback from everyone, and that'll help me find out which songs I need to use to actually, record them for an album.
That's so cool.
I'm kind of using a social media way to get people to connect with my songs, and they can give me feedback, and their feedback will be included on the eventual album.
Yeah, they can help build your album. I love it.
Exactly.
Cool. So, can they check you out anywhere coming up?
Yeah. The next major gig I'm trying to play out acoustic is on Saturday, April 13th. There's a Hurricane Sandy benefit concert being put on by Rich Wardlow, and he's doing it at the Hunterdon County Regional High School. And it's going to be like a drum corps is going to be there, and a whole bunch of other bands, musicians, including the Nerds and all that, and I get to play an acoustic set there around 1 p.m. So if you happen to be in the area, definitely come check it out.
And again, it's April 13th.
April 13th, yeah.
Cool. Well, excellent. That's really wonderful work you're doing. I just, it's kind of creepy or surreal, actually. I actually saw a few, was in a few different locations this week. I had a chance to go to Staten Island down by the old military base, and then I was in Lower Manhattan yesterday, and I just could not believe that here it is, what, 5 months after Hurricane Sandy, and so many places are still affected. It's just really eye-opening,
I think a lot of people just don't realize how bad it really was for certain areas.
Yeah, because it's, once it's not on the news and people aren't talking about it anymore, but that doesn't mean the problem has been solved, I was really, really shocked to see that, like, Lower Manhattan, so many businesses are still boarded up, and certainly for, small mom and pop businesses, they're having a hard time of it, so that's really wonderful work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Cool, well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Problem.
Yeah, it's always great to catch up, and I love hearing what you're up to.
Thank you.
Thanks. And you have a great rest of the spring, and well, it's not feeling like spring, but that is, we're officially in the season, and definitely have a great summer.
You too.
And we're back with Phil G. Welcome.
Hello.
Hey. Now, Phil, you're actually from London, England. And
that's
you are in out on the West Coast right now in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Cool.
That's
cool.
That's where I live now.
Now you were living in London in the 1980s, actually, what you called during Margaret Thatcher's England, Margaret Thatcher's Britain. And, you know, of course, she was very much like Ronald Reagan was for us, very staunch conservative and so forth. And you just wrote a book called Dirty Squatters.
Yeah.
And it chronicles, it's a true story about life during Thatcher's Britain.
That's right, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, basically, I started writing about 7 years ago, just as a sort of an analogy on my years, especially in the 80s and up to the mid-90s, about living in London and what it was like being a squatter in London, which is pretty much what everybody did in the 80s. It was a time before the internet, mobile phones, and we all used to meet in the pub or find each other somewhere in a park at a festival, and squatting was big back then. That's what everybody did, because there were lots of empty properties all over the place, and there were easy access, and life was kind of just a bit easier then, and it was a little bit more political as well. I think my generation, who are in their late 40s, mid-50s now, were pretty clued up politically, and we kind of had that we had that Thatcher thing going on where people they either loved her or they hated her, and that's probably pretty much the way it was with Reagan over here in the States as well.
Right. Of course, it's really interesting, you know, when you compare Ronald Reagan to some of the political people out now, particularly in the more conservative parties. I was like, wow, he actually looks like a liberal compared to some of the characters we have running now. But you know, and definitely here in New York, you know, it's so funny. I was reading the your foreword, actually. You were talking about, you know, people moving to London, chasing loads of money, and it really, you know, believe it or not, the movie and book that actually came to mind was American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis. But, you know, it's, again, because of the very similar kind of attitude, like, you know, in that book, it's people moving to New York, but it was definitely that yuppie kind of character that came here obsessed with money. And, but like you said, kind of living this, like you said in the foreword, rather, kind of living this life where people are kind of oblivious to other people around them and to what's going on around them.
I mean, that was very much like it. I mean, we had the yuppie culture here, which the majority of us, like, made fun of. But, you know, the majority of us weren't yuppies. You know, a lot of the people were kind of, like, having a really hard time under Thatcherism, you know. And, you know, for most of us, it wasn't so great. She was, like, closing down the industrial north and coal mining, a miners' strike. And, you know, a lot of the industrial power of Britain was being, you know, ebbed away. It was a sign of things to come. And lots of people were coming down from other parts of the country where the steel industry and all those heavy industries that Britain is known for were being crumbled, you know. So people were coming to London to look for new opportunities, and they basically ended up, you know, squatting, basically. And that's how so much of that subculture developed, you know. And it was, I mean, it was fun. I mean, we didn't, from my point of view, the people that I squatted with, we didn't destroy buildings. We moved into empty places because of council inability to house people that had been on waiting lists for years, and we were just empty properties, council flats and council houses. Obviously, they're called the projects in the USA,
right.
But we call them council houses in Britain, and we just moved in. We got the electricity sorted out, got everything else sorted out, got, you know, lived in the places and made them habitable.
Right.
And that's what we did.
Well, you know, it really, so much of this really parallels what happened in America, because you had, you know, during the OPEC crisis, you had, it was a tremendous blow, as you were saying, to the heavy industries, you know, America's current manufacturing industry, which really has not recovered. I mean, you had, you know, General Motors having to go ask Washington for a bailout. You had, you know, the steel industry, same thing. You had entire towns in what became known as the Rust Belt, you know, parts of Michigan, Ohio, where literally people just, I remember when my family.
Right. It was the capital of America, and it's one of the most poorest, most violent cities in the USA now.
Absolutely. Right. Well, I remember there was a saying when my family moved to Texas from Ohio. And there was a saying because so many people were moving down south, you know, from the Rust Belt. And there was kind of a joke saying, oh, well, you know, with the last person from Michigan, turn off the lights, you know. never recovered, really, since then. But kind of interesting because we don't seem to learn our lessons, you know. The big thing that really killed Detroit was the fact that the Japanese came up with cars that were much more fuel efficient, and Detroit was making these boat-sized cars. So what do they do?
The gas guzzlers, when the price of oil is going through the roof, you know. It's all about timing so much, you know.
Right. And then what is it that Detroit did recently? And they closed down Saturn, which was a part of GM, but then they were still making Hummers. like really?
Somebody buys them.
It's ridiculous. But how are things now? Just to kind of veer off topic, but I think a lot of things that a lot of Britain's history, recent history, since the Thatcher years I should say Margaret Thatcher was in office for many years. What, 11 years?
11 years. She got voted in 1979, and she actually got stabbed in the back by her own people in 1990. So she ruled Britain for all of the 80s, basically, so 79 to 1990. And in the end, her own spell was turned on her in the end and got rid of her, and that was it. And then we had a sort of a calm. I mean, we had another 5 years of John Major, it was still a right-wing government. So in the end of it, we had was it 17, 18 years of right-wing government, 79 till 98.
Wow.
I think it was when Tony Blair, New Britannia, and Cool Britannia, I think they called it, when Tony Blair arrived with his guitar and his amp, went into number 10 holding his guitar and his amp. That was the beginning of Cool Britannia, which lasted a little while until the Second Gulf War started, and then he went out of favour.
Right.
But I mean, I look at the book I've written, as a satirical, comical look back. It's about good times as well. Thatcher was a political angle that we all, we had that direction, our generation had that political direction and that, that sort of, we don't like her thing, whereas it's kind of mild down a bit now, it's a bit more diluted now than perhaps it was. Maybe people are less political or, the younger generations aren't so political, and my generation, we had that to deal with and we don't really want to go there again.
Right. I think the younger generations need to remember this, and the problem is, like here in the United States, they don't. They're totally out of touch with what's happening and what happened before. Of course, partly that's because of America's schools going down the tubes, also.
Yeah,
but
absolutely. I mean, in Britain, we've got a saying in Britain: a week is a long time in politics.
Right.
And it is, because somebody can just be in that political storm for a week. 2 weeks and then they're gone.
Right.
They've been demoted, they're out of the government, whatever, and then there's somebody else, some other face comes in. And it is just all so quick,
Right.
But I mean, the law has actually changed in Britain. I don't know if you know about this recently, but squatting has just been made illegal in Britain from last September. A new law was passed which now makes it illegal for one to enter a residential property that's been abandoned or not used or whatever, as nobody lives there. You can now be arrested for entering and living in an empty property. So that's now put a lot of people in difficulty because they can no longer find anywhere to live, which is going to be an empty building anyway.
Right. That is actually a problem. That is the law in the United States, that it is illegal to squat here. Which, it's interesting because there actually has been kind of a underground movement. There are certain groups here in New York City. I actually knew a young woman who was part of one of these groups that are doing it illegally, but kind of trying to promote it. But yeah, here in the U.S., you will get arrested if you try to squat. Which, you know, just, you know, I know you and I before the interview, we were talking about Donald Trump, and something that is just really disturbing to me is, you know, a lot of his properties, and he owns, you know, probably half of Manhattan. He's got so many buildings here. And a lot of them are sitting empty. Just empty. And the reason why is he actually makes more money. What he'll do is he sets the rents ridiculously high. I mean, some of his buildings, the rents are $10,000 a month or more, which who can afford that? Really? $10,000 a month for rent?
Obviously somebody can.
Well, actually, here's what happens is not that many people can. So then the unit just sits empty. He just has empty apartment units just not being used by anybody. But he gets a better deal on his taxes by just declaring it as a loss.
That's
fine, And really, it's a form of corporate welfare, really. You know, here in the U.S., they're so against, you know, giving people a safety net, you know, helping people with, you know, with public assistance. But yet we're giving public assistance in a way to a millionaire.
It's just the way it is. It's just the way things are for some, and it's not that way for others. In Britain, you can still actually squat a industrial building or an office block. And obviously, since the crash in 2008, there are obviously lots of office blocks standing empty that just didn't get refilled after. Haven't been refilled, so people can still effectively get into, you know, office blocks and things like that, and that has been going on as well.
Okay.
And they're prime locations. You've got a lovely office block with a great view in the city of London, you know, and there you go. You've got your nice place to stay. And obviously, the Iranian embassy was squatted after the siege back in the 80s as well.
Right.
You know, and that was good. You hear stories about, you know, various other quite posh places. But as far as residential squatting goes, it's been going into the projects and finding an empty place, which is crumbling anyway, moving in there and giving it a lick of paint and, you know, making the place habitable. You can't do that in Britain anymore. They've changed the law, and there's been a bit of an uproar. There's been a few waves have been sort of flowing over about that, because it's left a lot of people in quite serious difficulty. And there was a story on the news the other week that a guy was prevented by the police from entering a place to sleep at night, and consequently died out in the street because it was really cold.
Right.
That was in the news. You know, so things like that are going to happen now.
Yes.
Whereas basically, you know, I think one of the rights of every person is to be housed in a civilized society, isn't it?
Right.
If you've got to take the action, if you've got to take action yourself to get housed, then that's what you should do. Because if there's a building sitting there that's nobody's using, then you should live in it.
Right.
That's kind of how it should be, because otherwise the building will crumble without habitation. That's what buildings do. They crumble and they rot without people living in them.
Right. I mean, you know, you touched on a couple good points there. I think actually there was, if I'm not mistaken, I'm not an expert on this, I'm not going to pretend I am, but I believe it was under Vatican Council II where the Pope at that time, I believe Pope Paul VI, I don't know my history here, but I believe that it was, they issued a list of the basic rights of man. What basic rights does mankind have? And housing was one of them. I mean, you think
housing, food, clothing, isn't it?
Exactly.
The right to earn.
And the right to earn a living. Exactly. The very basic things that a human being should have, and a place to live. You know, and
you can't really do anything in life if you've got somewhere to live.
Right.
If you haven't got anywhere to live, you can't find a job. You can't.
That's right.
You can't wash your clothes. You can't wash yourself. So you fall into that cycle where you're on the streets basically, and you're done.
Right.
And until you can get off the streets, you know, which is what all the people that I ever squatted with. We always wanted to do something. You know, we always wanted, you know, we were musicians and artists, and we were like regular workers, whatever. You know, one guy lived with, he was working in a bank.
Right.
You know, he was a cashier in a bank, and he was a squatter. You know, he'd come home for lunch, and, you know, have his lunch, and then go back to the bank.
Right.
And this is, we were all doing jobs. You know, we were flying outside, passing out flyers outside clubs, or we were actually working in clubs or bars, or we were playing in bands or whatever, we were trying to do something with our lives.
Right.
But in order to do something with our lives, we had to have somewhere to live.
That's
collectively,
right.
Collectively, we'd all get together and there'd be half a dozen of us squatting in a place. And then maybe you'd only get 4 months or 5 months and then you get evicted and you have to go and find somewhere else in the middle of the night with your toolkit.
Right.
Which is in the book as well, there's the squatter's toolkit, it's in the book as well, which is the tools that you'd have, you know, that you take out when you've got your bag or everything you need to open the place up and to test the electricity in,
right.
All the rest of it. And we got one place, we were there for, you know, 8-10 years. And yeah, we got a lovely big Victorian house, and the place was crumbling, falling apart, the water was off, the ceiling was down, the roof was gone. We fixed it. You know, we got out there and we fixed the roof and we got the plumbing going. And you know, we had a band downstairs, had a rehearsal room downstairs with a full band. You know, and had amps, you know, PA down there. It's great. You know,
which is actually. It's actually better for the community because, you know, I know here in the 1980s in New York City, you had a lot of empty buildings that basically became shooting galleries. You know, for people shooting up heroin and so forth. Because, you know, that's what happened. It wasn't kept. It was an empty building that wasn't being used. And now a lot of them were given to the communities. They, you know, the city came in and gave that property to the community itself. And so some of the neighborhoods, particularly in the Lower East Side, in the Village area, a lot of the neighbors came in and tore down the building and planted community gardens, which is beautiful. I mean, now, unfortunately, it's come full circle where I know in down in by New York University, there's one community garden that now NYU is trying to kick the very community that took this, like you said, took it, cared for it, fixed it up, made it beautiful, and now NYU's trying to take it. I believe they want to put a hotel there.
Oh, right.
So it's like, you're taking from a community. That's just so wrong.
Yeah. It's funny the way it just swings around, you know, every 20 years. It just, you know, do you remember that? No, I don't remember that. Okay, we'll vote for that again then, shall we? We've not learned from history, do we?
Well, you know, what's interesting, and I'm a big fan of music, but what I love about music is I think it really tells a history of a people. And when you look at British music in particular, you really see, you know, you had this kind of glam rock, and you think of like the Rolling Stones in particular, dating all these models and stuff. And then you enter like the punk era. And what that was really a sign of was, I think, a lot of anger when you had young people coming from places like Newcastle where, like you said, there weren't any jobs.
And I mean, Newcastle was a powerhouse of the north.
Right.
And one of the guys I've worked with for years was from Newcastle, and he was a tough northern guy, you know, and he knew that he had to get out of Newcastle, and he did. And, you
right.
know, people I've squatted with are from all over the world, you know.
Right.
And, I mean, I'm not actually a Londoner, I'm from just outside London, but close enough.
Right.
But, we were all just converging there because, you know, what was happening where we were from was just, okay, I can't stay here anymore because I'm just not gonna. I'm not gonna survive. You know,
right,
I'm gonna go,
right.
I'm gonna go off and do this. And we ended up meeting people, coming together, and you know, we didn't. It's like I said, we didn't have mobile phones and we didn't have the internet. We just had, you know, we'd use like newspaper ads, and we'd walk round to the telephone box to make a call to somebody. You know, that's how we would do it. I'll meet you at the festival.
Right.
Where? You know, well, I'll meet you at the beer tent too. You'd always find them.
Right.
You know, it's like you see people turn up at festivals now in a park full of 50,000 people. They're on their phone. You can't hear anything because the music's banging away. And you see them standing there like, trying to talk on a mobile phone. And see, you know, what did we do before we had that? We always used to find each other. We always find each other. There it is. It's over there.
Well, in a way, I think we were closer as a society, believe it or not, before the cell phones. But, yeah, I saw a really good interview with Tony Ayalo from Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
And he was actually talking about Ozzy Osbourne, John. his real name is John Osbourne. And they were talking about where they grew up, I believe, in Birmingham and also in the north.
Yeah.
But they were talking about the conditions that they lived in. And I really don't think, again, when people hear an Ozzy Osbourne song, that they realize the conditions this guy grew up in, like poverty.
Proper working class, you know, Ozzy
right.
Osbourne, you know. I mean, Led Zeppelin, aren't they from there? There's quite a few big names from that part of the world, especially in music. Slade as well.
Right.
Now from there. Don't quote me on that. I'm not completely sure, but I think so. Quite a lot of big rock bands, I think Deep Purple, you know, from there. A lot of big rock bands came from that part of the world. And
when it explains the music.
In Birmingham.
Right.
Suffered a lot during the Thatcher years as well.
Right. It explains the anger, and which I think you saw in America, I think in the arts in general in America has completely been squelched by large corporations, and, you know, I think that's why it's so important to have independent media, which is what we're doing here, because we're not beholden to any corporation. But in the 90s, in the early 90s, I think that's what grunge was all about here in the United States, these groups like Nirvana. And again, it was kind of a backlash against the pretty boys of the 80s. You know, it was definitely the flannel wearing kind of grunge music. But what it was anger, and it's interesting because then, you know, throughout the I don't know what they're calling the year 2000s, but you had all this pop bubblegum nonsense. You know, the Britney Spears and all these Disney corporate produced music that, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But
it's still very much with us, sadly.
Right.
That's the way it is. But I mean, punk rock basically was, you know, it was something out of the grim 70s where the younger generation that just didn't want to go down that, you know, that same route that their parents had been down. And
right.
Music was getting a little bit, you know, prog rock, and people didn't want to listen to 15-minute guitar solos.
Right.
No 15-minute drum solos. Nobody wants to hear that. But basically, punk rock came out of like teenage rebellion.
Right, right.
Teenage boredom, basically. It was teenage boredom. So we're bored with this. We don't listen to this sort of boring stuff. We want something to go fast and furious. And that's when that whole movement started.
Yes.
And then it changed everything. It changed fashion. It changed attitudes. It changed the way people could perceive things. It changed people politically as well.
Right.
And it was not all about your haircut and the way you, you know, the way you dressed, you know.
Right.
It was an attitude of mind, and it kind of needed to happen, and that kind of thing needs to happen every 25 years or so or less. And it kind of needs to happen again.
Yes.
Because, you know, so much of what you say, the corporate monster is just controlling.
Yeah.
You know, the way people think, especially young people as well, which kind of concerns me. So this is the generation that's going to be looking after us. We're very
right.
Really old. Cranky.
Right.
I'll rely on myself, maybe. I don't know, but things change every so many years, and something else comes along, you know. And it's basically that was part of my youth. And that thing that I went through was part of my youth. And I look back on it and thought, okay, it was crazy days. It was fun. It was crazy, and it was also not counterproductive. And you know, we did something that was like what we did at the time. It was right at the time.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting because I'm, you know, now I've been hearing young people, like mostly college graduates, who are now expressing those same sentiments, the same anger. They're saying, you know, I'm graduating from college owing all of this money in student loans, and I can't get a job in my field.
Can't get a job in doing you know, just can't get a job working in a bar.
Right, right, exactly.
Know? It's a shame. It's really difficult for them to put themselves through all of that and put their parents through that debt as well as mount that debt on themselves. Exactly the same thing's happening in Britain.
Well, it's kind of the idea that you were lied to, you know, that society said, well, if you just do really well in school and you study hard and you go to college, you're going to get this great job, and then you realize that's bull. It's baloney. It's not true.
I mean, you basically, you stand a better chance of getting a better job if you have got a degree.
Right.
So in some respects, in many respects, it's got to be worth getting an education and doing it that way. But you've got a lot of competition, and I think this, like it's like they've been saying in Britain in some years ago, is that there's just too many people just wanting to be in the media. Everybody's those ways and ways of students are coming out of the universities with media studies degrees.
Right.
They really want to be in the media. They want to be somebody in the media. They think it's going to be just an easy one.
Right.
And flop straight into some great job in the media or going to be whatever in the media.
Right.
But they're screaming out for doctors, you know, architects, scientists, people that do sciences, you know, being denied mathematicians. Who wants to be an engineer nowadays?
Right.
That's not very glamorous. But, if, you know, I think if you come out of university with degree in engineering, you've got a much better chance of being headhunted than you have if you come out of the university with a degree in the media.
Right.
Because you've got all those other ways of people that have been out the last year, the year before, the 20 years before you, who've got more experience.
Well, and
it is a bit of a sucker punch for all the people that are actually going into the media now, whereas it's a bit overloaded, whereas, you know, some of the other sciences are not enough of a take-up.
Right. Well, unfortunately, like the media here, you know, you really and truly only have about six companies that own, you know, for instance, with television, you have about six companies that own all of the stations, all of the channels. And they're all making cuts. You know, it's actually kind of funny. I was interviewed on a certain network that I won't mention, but... when I got to the studios, I couldn't believe that they no longer provided hair and makeup people. There was no makeup artist. So they basically said, well, you know, I hope you brought your own makeup because you're going to have to do your own makeup. I was like, you got to be kidding me. And then when I walked in, they only had one guy remotely running all of the cameras, whereas they used to have a separate cameraman for each, you know, for each camera. So you can tell they're just, I mean, that's actually the whole reason they went to reality shows, which, by the way, started in England with Big Brother.
I know.
But it's because why? You don't have to pay actors, you don't have to pay writers. I mean,
that's the entire reason. Britain is guilty of reality TV, but it actually started with a program called Cast Away.
Oh, yeah.
They put, I don't know, 15 people on this island up in northern Scotland, and it was, they put them there on New Year's Day. It's like windy and cold and raining, and they had to build their accommodation right from the off, and the wind's flying in from the north, and it's, you know, January the 2nd, and they started filming it and thought, this would be good. And you could tell the people, you could tell immediately some people are just not going to make it straight away.
Right.
One of the guys, I think he's called Ben Fogle, he's gone on to have a really great career in the media. But you could tell the guy was going to be great when he was there. He was a great organiser. He was friendly. He could take it from anyone.
Right.
And be really calm and level-headed. And you always knew watching this guy, you know, sooner or later you're going to see him with his little bit on the TV show. And he's gone from strength to strength. And it's good luck to the fella, but you could obviously tell that some people weren't going to make it. And then all of a sudden, of course, Big Brother came along, of which I've never watched an episode of it anyway. I won't deny it. I absolutely hate it. But it ended a couple of years ago. It's the last one ever. Bye-bye. We're finished. We're moving out of the house. We're never going to be back. And then 9 months later, he's got a celebrity one. He's going to do another one.
Right.
They just brought it back. It's like, do you want to keep flogging a dead horse or what? You know, it's like,
right.
Keep bringing it back. Why? Is there demand there, or do they create the demand? I don't know.
I've had that argument with people before when they're like, well, this is what people want. And I said, well, is that really that what people want, or is it because there's nothing else available?
Well, I guess not. You know, you switch to another channel and it's like soap opera or whatever you want. You know, it's like, you know, I quite frankly, I don't really watch TV anymore. I kind of don't bother.
You know, it's interesting because that's another thing I'm hearing from a lot of young people now. And I think, you know, networks really need to take a lesson here and listen up because... A lot of young people are telling me that. They're like, you know what? Well, first of all, here in the United States, they went to the HDTV, meaning you basically have to have cable in order to get television now. And, well, my parents have an old analog TV, so they were able to get an adapter.
They can't get anything.
Yeah. Well, they were able to get an adapter, and I think they, for certain people, they did.
Tune into the moon land.
Right. So, but yeah, for most people, if you have to either have a brand new TV, which, you know, great spurred on that business there, or you have to get cable TV. And the cable and, you know, satellite television companies are just, they're running a racket. You know, they usually start you out with the sign up for the bundle package, you know, and, oh, you'll get internet and phone and cable for $100 or whatever. And then after a year, they, you know, double your price. So a lot of young people are saying...
You can always do the alternative thing and actually go out and socialize.
Yeah, right?
You get to just go out.
Right.
Why not?
Well, and yeah, a lot of young people are saying, you know what, to hell with TV, I don't need it. And you know what, I can go online and I can, you know, go to Hulu and watch whatever show I did like watching. And the rest is garbage, you know. It's like, once you've seen The Bachelor, The Bachelorette, I'm like, it's all the same damn show, for God's sake, you know.
I sat in last week and watched All Night Zombies, right. You know, one after the other. Yeah, the zombie or whatever it was, you know, it's just, I just kept watching it, you know, it's about 10 episodes of zombies, I won't name the show, we all know it.
Right.
And it was just like, okay, I'll just keep watching this.
Right, exactly.
That was horrible. That's another grisly way of dismembering a zombie.
Definitely. But yeah, I think it's, as Bob Dylan said, the times are definitely changing, right? The times are changing. Yeah. But
absolutely.
To end on a cool note, I love this story because, you know, New York is just getting gobbled up by, you know, property speculators and developers left and right. And there is one property in, I believe it's in Tribeca, actually. It's an apartment building in Tribeca. And nobody can sell it. It's gone through three different development companies, and nobody wants to buy this thing because there is a group of squatters that's been there for the past 17 years, living rent-free in Manhattan. I'm like, good for them. I just love that story.
Well, I mean, the law in Britain formerly used to be is that if you could occupy a place for 12 years or more and show that you were living there, an unbroken cycle for 12 years, and prove it, such as a bank statement or an electricity bill with your name on,
right,
or anything like that, probably the paperwork, you could then claim the property for yourself, so long as nobody in those 12 years had come back to claim the property back,
right,
or made a claim on it. You could actually, after 12 years, you could actually apply for the property to be given in your name.
Right.
There have been a number of stories down the years where, you know, some bloke has been in this place for 17 years, and he's ended up getting quite a nice house, actually, you know. He's
right.
He looked after it. And then he sticks it on the market, and then all of a sudden he's like, you know, £250,000 better off. And he's just like, well, how much is this house worth? That was £250,000.
Right.
I'll sell up and go somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, the guy has actually lived there, or the people have lived there, and looked after it. Otherwise, the place would have just fallen down.
Exactly.
I mean, in a way, it's a benefit, you know. So these people in Manhattan who've been squatting there for 17 years, they won't move. Good for them.
Good for them, exactly. Well, because, you know, what you really see is right now this over-the-top greed on the part. You know, a perfect example, I'm very much anti-stadium because for some reason in this country we have this belief that we need to have all these new stadiums every couple of years, and I'm like, you know, hasn't the Roman Colosseum stood for like 3,000 years and it's still there? You know, do we really need to build new stadiums every year? And the argument is always, oh, it's going to create jobs. And I say, okay, well, it might create some construction jobs, you know, at the time it's being built. Of course, we just built a new stadium here in Brooklyn. Never mind the fact that Mike Bloomberg, our mayor, wants to close 19 schools in Brooklyn, but, you know, we can build a stadium. And the land he took for the stadium was taken through public domain, eminent domain, I'm sorry, which I don't know if they have that in Britain. Basically, what that says is, the city can come in and say, oh, we need your property because we need it for some public good. And in this case, the public good was a basketball stadium. I don't know if I were a homeowner, I'd be really pissed. But so that's how they actually got some of the land to build the stadium, was through eminent domain. They literally took people's land. And so now they built the stadium, and it's a hideous eyesore, and it's right in the middle of a neighborhood with historical, beautiful brownstone homes, So right there, again, if I were the homeowner, I'd be really upset. But the argument was, oh, it's going to create all these jobs. Well, along Atlantic Avenue is the big avenue that leads up to the stadium. And since it opened, about eight businesses have closed since it opened. And the reason was the minute they opened that thing, the landlord said, oh, look, a stadium. Now we can triple your rent. And the problem is it just totally kills the mom-and-pop business. You know, everything that made, particularly this part of Brooklyn, was very historical. I mean, you have buildings here from the Revolution, from George Washington. I mean, these old historical buildings. And it had a kind of a really cool flavor. Lots of little artisan shops and unique little stores. And none of them can stay in business with the rents as they are. So what we get instead are the chain stores, you know, the Applebee's, the, you know, Petco. That kills, absolutely kills the flavor of the neighborhood. You know, it's...
Yeah, it's exactly the same thing that's been happening in Britain. They're moving away from a high street society to, more or less shopping mall.
Yeah.
Society, but you go into the centre of town, it's easier to park, and you can go into the shopping mall and buy everything from every shop that looks the same as every shop everywhere else.
In everywhere.
It's got their little thing in the same thing everywhere.
Right.
And if you want that sort of different touch, you want that sort of nice touch and personal touch, you have to go to little villages somewhere that's
right.
just been unaffected by 21st century surge of the shopping mall thing.
Yeah.
Every city's got one now.
Right.
You go through, any city now, you can see all the rows and rows of shops that are just closed down. They just couldn't make it.
Right.
It's 2008, and it's 2008. It's basically, we couldn't make it. So that closed down. You see pretty ugly high streets now where it's just, shut the windows and you see all the newspaper and the floor and everything. And it just,
right.
We need to squat that, don't we?
Well, it really is, like here in the United States, I say that's killing the American dream. Because you might talk to the little girl who, in high school said, oh, I want to open a dance studio or a ladies boutique. Or maybe there was a guy who said, I want to open, whatever, a bar, whatever. Nobody ever says, when they're in school, hey, I want to one day work for Kmart. I want to one day get a crappy minimum wage job working at Target. And so you really have killed that sense of entrepreneurship. And this is actually a pathetic and sad story that I was in China, in Beijing, in 2004. And, I actually had to look to find a Chinese restaurant in China. And, the first couple of days that I was in Beijing, I was like, well, I see the Kentucky Fried Chicken and the McDonald's. And I'm like, oh, it's just so pathetic. As a matter of fact, I saw Lord of the Rings when it came out there. And I'm like, just so pathetic that it's the same thing everywhere.
Yeah.
So it's
world of sameness.
Yeah. Well, Phil, it has been a pleasure talking with you today.
Likewise.
Let me ask you, if people would like to get your book, it's called Dirty Squatters.
Yeah.
Where can they go?
It's on Amazon. It's on Amazon for Kindle. And obviously not everybody's got a Kindle. But it's also on Thirsty Fish. And also on a place called Library, which is spelt with a Y, that's L-Y-bury. And you can download it in various formats at Library, which is available in the USA. And it's on Amazon.com and Amazon.co.uk, and I think it's available pretty much everywhere. But if you Google it, you'll find it, Phil G, Dirty Squatters, you'll find it out there. But a lot of people are going to go to Amazon, but if not, it's out there on a few other formats as well.
Cool. So it's Dirty Squatters.
Uh-huh.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's lovely speaking to you, and thanks very much for having me on your show.
It's a pleasure.
And I look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Definitely. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Hi, this is Dorian DeLeonardo.
And Tony DeLeonardo.
And we're the Progressive Union, the forward-thinking duo from the Big Apple.
And each week on the Progressive Union, we dish on the news, politics, and pop culture that the corporate media ducks.
Our goal is to inform, enlighten, entertain,
and hopefully enrage.
So join us on the Progressive Union, exclusively heard on www.thirdstrikeradio.com.
Take a bullet to my chest because I know the fear is not real. For nobody knows where you go when you're leaving this world. Oh no, you just keep in mind that you won't be alone. So I'm leaving this life of fear in search of brighter days. I know you've heard it all before.
And we're back with Bougie and the High Rise. Welcome.
Hey, thanks.
Hey. Now you're calling us from the Big Easy from New Orleans, Louisiana.
Yes, we are.
Cool, cool. And who are Bougie and the High Rise?
Bougie and the High Rise. It's Lampier, Jordan Lewis, Cameron Doty, and Logan. Bates, drum, guitar, and Logan Lee.
Cool. Cool, cool. Now, how did you get the name Bougie and the High Rise?
We got the name by meditating in a favorite manner on our, at the time, favorite couch. And, you really just had to think of, something that would, you know, slide off the tongue nice and, meditating helped come up with the name.
Cool. That's very cool. I gotta say, I also really love your artwork. I saw the your logo that you have is really cool. Like, very kind of psychedelic.
Thank you.
Very cool. Now, let me ask you, who were some of your musical influences?
Some of our musical influences are
of course.
Right. That's pretty much it. That's a lot.
That is a lot, right? Very cool. Very cool.
Oh, okay. Can't forget Michael Jackson.
But would you say now your music you would describe as like a reggae kind of fusion, or?
Yeah, it's a kind of fusion of reggae, rock, hip hop, and
very cool. Very cool. Well, let me ask you, since we are on the Green Living Show, what are some of your green beliefs?
Some of my green beliefs, well, most of us live in an area where we recycle. So, instead of throwing, like, some bottles of water away, we finish, we do the recycling thing. Also, we carpool a lot. A lot of places we go.
Oh, cool. That's very cool. Excellent. Excellent, excellent. Well, let me ask you, are you guys working on anything right now?
Working on new songs and material, writing.
You got a new album coming up?
Yeah, new songs, we just haven't started recording yet.
Cool. Very cool. And I notice you guys play all over Louisiana.
Yeah, Lake Charles is probably our best place.
I love Lake Charles. Actually, I'm from Texas, so I went there many, many times.
Really?
Yeah. Sorry?
Where are you from?
Houston.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, not that far. But I love when they put in the casinos, we would go quite frequently. So, yeah. So you got any gigs or anything coming up?
Yeah, we're playing at the Office Bowl on Friday night. Courthouse. And then Saturday night.
Very cool.
Following after, we got Thursday before all that. Thursday night at Checkpoint Charlie on a freshman.
Very cool. Well, you guys keep busy.
Yeah, we're going to Austin on 420. We're playing just a glass and art festival.
Awesome. Austin on 420. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
We actually, it's so funny, our 420 show is our highest rated show every year.
Yep. That's actually our birthday.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, if people would like to check you out, where should they go? Do you have all the social media, the Reverb and all of those?
Yeah, we're on Facebook, and we have Instagram too. That's pretty hip. Yeah, Bandcamp is where you can get that record for free.
Oh, awesome.
It's BougieAndTheHighRise.bandcamp.com.
Very cool. Well, thank you guys for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
Yeah, really appreciate talking to you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for having us on.
My pleasure.
No problem.
Well, that's a wrap. Thank you for joining us. If you'd like to learn more about Build a Better Planet, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to our website, www.buildabetterplanet.org. Want to help build a better planet? We offer volunteer and internship opportunities. You can write to us at Build a Better Planet, 545 8th Avenue, Suite 401, New York, New York, 10018. Join us again next Monday at 9 p.m., and remember to keep it simple, keep it constant, and keep it green. And together we can build a better planet.
Take a bullet to my chest, because I know the fear is not real. For nobody knows.